careers and their musical collaboration and its first single, La-Di-Da. Don't miss this conversation with these multi-hyphenate powerhouses on Thursday, September 22nd at 9 p.m. on the next Backstage Stories.
The time now is 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Agenda Radio here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.
Welcome to Black Agenda Radio, where we provide news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Margaret Kimberly. In today's segment, we discuss the prosecution of a survivor of domestic abuse and the ways in which those with past felony convictions struggle to maintain their voting rights. But first, we talk about efforts to silence and erase defenders of Palestinian rights from social media and all public life. Welcome to Black Agenda Radio. I'm Margaret Kimberly. Laith Marouf is policy consultant with the Community Media Advocacy Center in Montreal. He is a longtime defender of Palestine and the rights of Palestinian people. He has been publicly attacked by Zionist organizations in Canada and even by Prime Minister Trudeau and members of the United States Congress. He joins us from Montreal. Tell our listeners what you've been going through, the public attacks on you, the doxing, the social media harassment, the fact that you've been disappeared from social media.
It all started, obviously, because of my work within the frameworks of policy and law that deals with the rights of racialized indigenous and disability communities in the broadcasting sectors. As you mentioned in the beginning of this, I am a policy consultant for the Community Media Advocacy Center, which is the leading organization globally on these files, and we appear in front of the broadcasting commissions like the Canadian Radio and Television Commission, advocating for the rights of these groups that are protected under the law, and have had huge achievements and consulted the governments of Mexico on their indigenous radio policies, consulted the South African government on their community television and radio policies. This organization and its work achieved a lot also in Canada in terms of enforcing the rights of racialized and indigenous peoples to employment, access, and reflection that is equitable under the law in the television stations. So they came for my tweets in regards to Jewish white supremacy and my critiques for apartheid and the genocide that is ongoing in Palestine, and said that this these tweets are anti-Jewish. And the work that's thus of CMAC, the Community Media Advocacy Center, which has been contracted by the Ministry of Heritage in Canada to map out, with the help of racialized and indigenous broadcasters and media producers, academics, and the communities, to map out a anti-racist policy for the Canadian broadcasting sectors, and thus that pressure that the Zionists brought in on social media was put on the Canadian government to force it to break the contract that was there with CMAC, the Community Media Advocacy Center. This is where it started, and it just blew out from there. It's crazy how the attention that they are focusing on my tweets which are also misrepresented.
So you are no longer on Twitter. Your account was removed.
Members of the Parliament of Canada, along with congressional representatives and members of parliaments of the other Anglo colonies and the Zionist colony, all coming together to condemn the tweets of Leith Maruf. That was, I have never seen such a thing before. My Twitter account was coupled in their discussions with the only two accounts that were named were mine and that of the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. It was hilarious, the absurdity. What was funny also, I saw, and I've never known this before, when I watched this, these presentations online, is that the special envoy of the Canadian government to combat anti-Semitism, former Minister of Justice Erwin Cutler, his daughter was on the committee representing the Knesset of Israel. His daughter is a dual citizen and was there condemning my tweets that were making fun of her father. It was funny to see the collusion. I mean, people don't understand. The issue at hand here is that the children of people like Erwin Cutler or the members of the American Congress and members of Canadian Parliament that are aware of this testimony, they can just get on a plane from New York, from Chicago, from Toronto, from Montreal, land in Palestine, pick up a gun, go out hunting for Arabs, go out hunting, take their land, take their homes, like Joseph of Brooklyn, the very famous video of him saying, if I don't take it, steal it, somebody else will, like, you know, in the neighborhoods of Jerusalem. And then they can come back, roam the streets of New York, and roam the streets of Toronto and Montreal with no consequence. But my tweets in their own hands and kill a Palestinian with no consequence and come back, my tweets against them apparently are the violence, not their physical action that is possible. They think that there is something, you know, they actually believe in reverse racism, it seems like. They don't understand that the concept of racism requires the possibility of real consequence for the prejudice. I cannot pick up a gun and go assassinate a Zionist and have no consequence to it. This is where the racism comes. And they want, if you saw those presentations, again, it's unbelievable. They live, I believe, on a different plane of existence when they speak, and they actually cannot hear the echo of their words. They were demanding from Twitter, from Meta, YouTube, and TikTok to include the Zionist ideology, political ideology, as a identity that is protected. And they want, basically, because it was so funny, they were saying, well, it has nothing to do with Judaism. There's also a lot of Zionists who are not Jewish. This is what they were saying. And therefore, this is as a political identity, they want to have a colony based on Jewish supremacy is apparently an identity that should be protected by the law. And anyone who doesn't believe in this political ideology and doesn't pledge allegiance to a foreign colony of apartheid are anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic. This is why It's unbelievable what level they want to reach. And this is a problem not for only Palestinians. The Zionists, to achieve such a thing, it opens the door for religiosity, basically, where it will be the religion of the state, will be Zionism. If you don't believe in bringing the end of time, basically, through ethnic cleansing and genocide, then the state is going to wipe your existence off the record.
You said that they live on a different plane of existence, and it's the plane of existence of the powerful. These same groups and individuals got the Prime Minister of Canada to take time to condemn you. And that tells you the level of power that they have, the fact that and it tells us also about social media and their connections with the state. And there, it was a naive hope that we would all be able to express ourselves through social media, but there are limits. And if you cross any of their lines, they turn you into a non-person. And they've done this not just with you, but with other people. And it seems they have a... what they do to silence people is that they try to ruin someone's life and make an example of them. And that silence, and it works because it silences people. People censor themselves. No one wants to be kicked off of social media, condemned by a head of government, excoriated in Congress, and so forth. And the Canadian government took the funding of CMAQ, did they not?
Yeah, so the contract was for... $133,000. It's a very small contract to hold six gatherings across the nation, coast to coast, bringing in all the racialized and indigenous producers in the various broadcasting sectors with the academics from those communities and their community organizations. We had already done half of the work, three out of the six events, before the Zionist stalkers, managed to get politicians involved, so they cut the contract. The consequence, worst possible consequence under the contract, is they can take what hasn't been spent. We're still in the mediation process with the lawyers of the government. We'll see where that goes. Beyond this moment in Canada specifically is around the various ministries enforcing the nefarious and purposefully loaded interpretation of what is quote-unquote anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish behavior, written by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA. At the time, Erwin Cutler, the current czar of anti-Semitism here in Canada, was one of the people that pushed that definition. And it includes that any criticism of Zionism or the State of Israel basically is, they will consider it anti-Jewish, or quote-unquote anti-Semitic. And this is where the problem lies here, that if the Ministry of Heritage will now be vetting any applicants for funding for their support of the IHRA definition, that means that all cultural and arts initiatives in the country, including all the biggest festivals and all the various arts and culture events and funding mechanisms, and the indigenous radio sector, the whole indigenous radio sector receives this funding directly from the Ministry of Heritage, all of them basically will be having to pledge this oath of allegiance to Zionism as a political ideology and the state of Israel as a colony that of apartheid.
Order to silence people in order to keep people from stating these very simple and easily provable facts that you have to try to destroy someone. It tells you that the Palestinian cause is a just cause. They, in their zeal to assassinate someone's character, they actually prove your point. And we see this here in the U.S. And the media, the not just social media, corporate media in general, working with the state. There was an interesting article in the New York Times a few days ago on September 18th about Linda Sarsour, who is also, I believe she is Palestinian, has advocated for the Palestinian cause. Her character was assassinated here a few years ago. She was involved in the women's marches in the wake of Donald Trump's victory. And as with you, Zionist groups harassed her, destroyed her character. But the New York Times article from September 18th said that it was Russian bots. It was the Russian government that stirred up this animosity against her and disappeared completely the Zionist attacks on her and the New York Times joining in those attacks. What do you think of that?
Of course, she has her problem in not understanding that trying to play the politics of the United States, a colony based on genocide of indigenous people and the continued genocide of the indigenous people and the continued segregation policies and systemic racism against people from African or Asian or Latin American origin. You know, this... It will never work out for the Palestinians to think that you can get through lobbying anything from the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, the establishment in the United States, to actually think that the Palestinians can cut line before the indigenous people or descendants of the cross-Atlantic slavery and receive somehow equality from the Imperial Senate in Washington, D.C., it's a weird... I don't understand how people think that they can do that. And then to not be prepared for being... thrown away by the system when you're not convenient to it, you get too hot. I personally have lived this constant attempts of erasure, and I've worked with all the various labor unions and, you know, centers of power and different communities, and I can tell you there is no way for a change in the policies of Canada or the United States around Palestine, and, you know, through a democratic means. The change has to happen on the ground in Palestine, where the Zionists have to be defeated. Otherwise, the imperial order is too interested in maintaining the situation of war in Western Asia and North Africa and to maintain the physical fracturing of the Arab people and Arab lands in ways that it makes it impossible for the region to develop harmoniously and unify or controlling some of the most important pathways of trade in the world and some of the most important resources in the world. This is the main reason the Zionist colony exists. Well, I would just like to direct people to my website, laithmarouf.com, LAITHMAROUF.com. And because we are now trying to raise funds to campaign legally to stop the Ministry of Heritage here in Canada from enforcing these loyalty oaths on all funding applicants. And this is an important battle that will set, you know, the freedom and rights of not only Palestinians here in Canada, but also all the citizens. And it will make sure that no other government agency can implement such a racist interpretation of what is anti-Jewish, you know, commentary or hate.
That was Laith Marouf joining us from Montreal, discussing Zionist attacks on his rights to speak about Palestine and Palestinian rights. Welcome to Black Agenda Radio. I'm Margaret Kimberly. Sama Cisse is an attorney and an organizer with the group Survived and Punished, which advocates for the rights of criminalized survivors. She joins us today from New York City to talk about the case of Tracy McCarter, a woman who will be tried for murdering her abusive estranged husband. A judge refused to allow a charge of manslaughter, which prosecutors belatedly supported. During his campaign, Manhattan's district attorney promised not to prosecute abuse survivors, but his record in office is different.
Tracy McCarter is a Black woman, a nurse, a mother, a grandmother, a student, who was living in Manhattan and was assaulted by her estranged husband in March 2020, which resulted in his death, the altercation that happened between them. Tracy called 911 and, you know, like I stated, as a nurse, was administering first aid when the police arrived. And immediately, without any investigation, when they arrived on the scene, what you see is a Black woman and a white man who was injured or presumably dead. They arrested her. And she ended up on Rikers during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic. Truly, why I really say without investigation, they arrested Tracy is that if you looked deeper into the story, you would realize that Tracy McCarter is a survivor of domestic violence, someone who was defending herself against abuse and assault at the time. But all of these things didn't matter. She was on Rikers and she was denied bail multiple times. And Survived and Punished learned about Tracy's case not long after she was arraigned. And we got in contact with her, with her family, and we felt it was really important to uplift her case and start a campaign for Tracy so that people would learn what's happening in Manhattan, right? I think at the time, Cy Vance was viewed as this progressive prosecutor, yet here was this Black woman who had survived and endured so much trauma, and she was being re-traumatized by the criminal system. And the DA office was pushing through to prosecute her for murder. Even though, again, if you looked at the facts, you would see that it was an instance of self-defense. And so through advocacy, Tracy was able to get, you know, a good team of lawyers. We were able to get media attention to her case. You know, her family really rallied and advocated for her. And eventually she was released in the fall of 2020. But she was released on ankle monitoring, on electronic monitoring. And during that period, you know, we had the Manhattan DA race coming up. And so folks were hopeful, right? Like Cy Vance's office was not doing the right thing. They were not, you know, looking at this case the way it needed to be looked at and really understanding the full scope of the situation, but instead were charging ahead to prosecute this woman. And so the campaign continued. And, you know, when Alvin Bragg rose as like the leading candidate in the campaign, people were hopeful that, you know, something different might happen with this case. And even during his campaign, as you stated, Bragg was, you know, quoted saying, you know, I support Tracy McCarter. I support survivors. However, what we saw was when he came into office, nothing really changed. The office continued their prosecution. I will say what did change was the amplification of Tracy's case. I think more people at the time Brad came into office were aware of who she was. We were doing a lot more advocacy. Her lawyers were really, you know, fighting her case, and really there was a lot of attention. And so there were discussions that were happening. You know, our call has always been, the Manhattan DA has the discretion to drop this case. They can choose, they can decline to prosecute this case. They can do the right thing, right? Like, this is power that they have. And if they had done it from the very beginning, we wouldn't be going on now almost 3 years of Tracy going through this terrible criminal punishment system, right? And so eventually they reached a point, like you mentioned, where I think they thought the best thing they could do was at least get rid of the murder charge, right? So they argued that, you know, looking at all the facts, yeah, you know, they recognized that she was a survivor of domestic violence. They wouldn't be able to prove murder at trial, even though that's what they told the grand jury and that's what they indicted her at the grand jury, and didn't tell the grand jury any of the history of abuse that her estranged husband had, right? Not only of Tracy, but of his prior wife as well. So they were able to get her indicted at the grand jury on murder. So they then turn around after all of this advocacy pushing them and be like, okay, yeah, you're right. We can't really prove murder. So we're going to drop the charge to manslaughter. And what the judge in the case said when they did that was, this is so strange. Like, you have motions on motions where you're arguing, you have all this evidence to prove murder and you have all these things, and now you're going back and saying, oh, actually, we can't prove a murder charge, so let's drop it to manslaughter. And also the manner in which they went about doing it was just not a normal way of trying to drop a charge or to remove. Of course, they need to re-present it to the grand jury, and they didn't do that. And so the judge denied the change in charge, denied the dropping of the murder charge. And so, as you stated, we are at a point now where Tracy is preparing to go to trial for murder.
Alvin Bragg came into office making other promises as well. He came into office saying that they would not ask for jail time for certain low-level offenses. And he was immediately attacked by Mayor Eric Adams, for whom quote unquote law and order is his never ending stump speech. And he backtracked from that promise. Talk to us about the pressure that district attorneys are under to prosecute at the harshest level possible.
What we saw was DA Alvin Bragg came into office and really put forth this policy for his office that was viewed as more lenient. And he did get a lot of pushback, and he continues to get a lot of pushback from the conservative law and order, you know, parts of New York. However, you know, while there is pressure on prosecutors and specifically on DAs, to run their office in specific ways in the interest of, you know, as people say, public safety, though we know it's really a system that is racialized and is focused on punishment, and oftentimes punishment of those who are Black and poor. We know that regardless of this, they always have discretion, right? So regardless of all of this external pressure for him to prosecute in a certain way, to be a law and order person, he recently dropped a murder case. This was in the media around a bodega owner, right? This bodega worker who stabbed someone during an altercation, stabbed this person multiple times during an altercation and was being charged with murder. And yet we have the opposite, right? We had, you know, people being like, well, especially to be fully honest, like conservative parts of the New York City politics system being like, oh, this is a business owner. This was an individual who was not Black, who killed a Black person. And who came in their store, and apparently there was an altercation between them and they stabbed them. And they're saying, well, he had the right. He was protecting his store. Like, why would he be charged with murder? And because of that pressure, what we saw was the Manhattan DA office decided that they were going to drop that charge. They didn't even bring it to the grand jury, in fact. Before they could present the case to the grand jury, they dropped the charge completely. right? So I think it's true that there is outside pressure, but I think it can go both ways. And DAs and politicians generally listen to who they think are powerful. And in this case, they think people like us who are advocating for leniency, or people who are advocating for the rights of individuals who are survivors and then are pulled into the criminal system and further punished for daring to survive assault, abuse, whatever they've gone through, they think that our voices don't matter. And so when we're pushing, they take their time, right? And they don't listen. But when you have, you know, business owners and people with wealth and whatever, you know, saying to them, well, we should be able to protect our businesses from these, you know, whatever word you want to use, black people who are coming into our businesses, then it seems like it's okay. It's something that then they can be lenient and say, oh no, these are not the people the justice system was made, right, to prosecute. So what was the difference between Tracy McCarter protecting or defending her life in her own home, in her own apartment, and someone supposedly defending themselves in their place of business, right? But they try really hard to justify that action and to then drop the charge, which was successful.
You know, the other thing interesting about the killing in the bodega is that the mayor actually said that I think this person shouldn't be charged. Very irregular for a mayor, but Bragg, having already been beaten up by Eric Adams and his police commissioner, who emailed all the cops in everybody with an NYPD email address, am I correct? In order, and said that Bragg was making them less safe by not sending everybody to jail, which was also very improper. And let me also add, parenthetically, everybody I've just named is black. District Attorney Bragg, Eric Adams, the mayor, and the police commissioner. So this is a very interesting moment in our city where we have a mayor who sees it as being helpful to him to be as harsh as possible, to involve himself in these cases when he should not, and he's not taken to task for doing so.
Yes, that's correct. It's selective, right? You're right. We're living in an era right now in New York City where individuals with power are technically representative of the black community. And so I think the message that a lot of people think that sends is that, well, they are obviously the things that they do and the ways that they move is representative of what the broader community wants. But we know that's not true. There have always been black faces in high places who do not push for things that are right. And there are people who uphold systems that are oppressive, even though they come from groups that have been oppressed. And we know this to be true, right? And so I'm not sitting here and saying that, like, you know, Alvin Bragg is a terrible human being who is trying to oppress black people. I'm saying he works within a system, right? That is what that system does. And by working in that system, there are certain things that are expected and required of him. And if he were to choose to push against it, as he has tried, there would be backlash. But it's this, what I'm really getting at is the selectiveness. Like you were saying, why did Eric Adams all of a sudden have something to say about that case and not the other cases of people who have acted in self-defense and are now, you know, being pulled into the criminal punishment system, right? Because it fits his interest, right? To get business owners, to get certain groups to support him, to say, like, this is our mayor. This is someone who will support business interests, who will support small business owners, right? And so it's, the system is not actually about public, you know, public safety. It's not about law and order. It's about power. And it's about doing things, that serve the interests of those who have power. And so that's what we're facing right now, regardless of the race of those individuals. And so we are building power within people in New York City to push back and to say, you know, you may think Tracy McCarter, this, you know, just this black woman, this nurse, like, doesn't have any power, doesn't have support, and that you can just disappear her into the system, but we refuse. we're coming together as a collective saying, no, we are going to keep pushing until you release her, until you drop her charges, because that is the right thing to do, even if it brings backlash, even if it doesn't win you some accolade in terms of power among political figures or elected officials, because that shouldn't be your focus. Your focus should be actually on serving the people of New York, as you claim you're in power to do.
It seems that punishing Black people, or in the other case of the killing in the bodega, not punishing people who punish Black people, is always a politically expedient thing to do. Your organization, Survived and Punished, who advocates on behalf of those who survive abuse, I'm guessing that most of those that you are advocating for are women of color. Is that correct?
That's correct. A majority, we work with individuals who are not women as well, but a majority of the people who we work with are women of color who are incarcerated in New York State prisons or are currently being prosecuted in New York State. Survived and Punished is also a national organization. So there are chapters in California, in Illinois, and Chicago. And so the broader network supports people all over the United States who are either incarcerated or are currently being prosecuted. But, you know, the stats are there, the numbers show, right, that a majority of individuals in women's prisons are survivors of either some form of domestic or sexual violence. And that fact is often not taken into account during their criminal proceedings.
And when does Tracy McCarter go to trial?
So the date has not been set yet. There are various hearings that are happening before the trial actually starts, but it would be fall of this year.
And how can our listeners find out about the work of Survived and Punished?
You can visit our website, which is just survivedandpunishedny.org. And we also have information on the website about Tracy's case, including various petitions that you can sign to support her case. And Color of Change has also started a campaign to also push DA Bragg. And they have, you know, a moving story, a video that they put together where they interview Tracy's son and some of the people in her life to talk about her story and why they think she should be free. We also have a fundraiser on there. We're raising funds to help Tracy care for herself because she can't work and she's living in Manhattan and she can't work. She's a nurse, but obviously she's, you know, on electronic monitoring and she's facing murder charges. So she's not working right now. And it's a very difficult position to be in. So we've been doing our best to raise funds so that she can cover her living expenses and other needs.
That was Sama Cisse joining us from New York City, discussing the case of Tracy McCarter and other survivors who are punished by the criminal justice system. Welcome to Black Agenda Radio. I'm Margaret Kimberly. Across the United States, people with felony convictions can have severely restricted access to the franchise, and in some cases may be denied the right to vote forever. Blair Bowie is senior legal counsel and Restore Your Vote manager at the Campaign Legal Center, which provides assistance through restoreyourvote.org. She joins us from Washington, D.C. So we have 50 states, and as with so many other issues, we have we can have up to 50 different rules. What is the landscape like for voting rights for those convicted of felonies?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The landscape is checkered and complicated. Lots of states have different laws around when people lose their voting rights for a felony conviction and around how they get them back. Across the country, there's about 5 million people who are barred from voting by law because of past felony convictions. Some of those people could restore their voting rights through their state's process, but most will have to wait until they finish probation or parole. Some are even permanently barred from voting, and often many people are barred from voting because they are unable to pay back fines, fees, or restitution. But more broadly, the vast majority, over 80% of people with past felony convictions, actually do have the right to vote in their states. There's over 19 million Americans who have past felonies who do have the right to vote, but many people don't know about that. And the myth that all people with felony convictions are permanently barred from voting is really persistent and keeps a lot of people from participating.
How many states permanently bar voting rights for those convicted of felonies?
Only a handful of states permanently bar people from voting after felonies. Some states permanently bar people who had convictions that were related to elections from voting, things like voter fraud. But there's a number of states like Alabama, Tennessee, Florida, that keep folks who have more serious convictions like murder or sexual convictions from voting without a pardon.
It's interesting to me whenever we talk about it, it seems that whenever we talk about the states that are most punitive about any number of issues, they seem to be in the South. You mentioned Florida. Florida is an interesting case because a few years ago, there was a voter referendum. Florida made it, was one of those states that made it almost impossible for those with past convictions to regain voting rights. And there was a voter referendum which changed that policy and restored, which was intended to restore the rights of those convicted after they had served their terms. But there was great resistance, despite the fact that this is what voters wanted, and I believe it was not even a close vote, but there was a great deal of resistance, and now it is among those states where you have to make restitution, and the process is even more difficult. It seems like the public are more willing to make these changes than political leadership are.
Yeah, I think that's right, and just to return to the point you just made about, you know, these laws being strictest in the South. I do think it's important to note whenever we're talking about these laws, you know, where they come from and what they're intended to do. Felony disenfranchisement laws really proliferated across the U.S. starting after the Civil War, and they were pioneered by Southern states who were looking to find ways around the promise of the Reconstruction Amendments of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. So when those states passed new constitutions to rejoin the Union, they explicitly said that their constitutions were designed to protect the system of white supremacy. And felony disenfranchisement was a really important part of that strategy for them. They expanded the criminal legal system to target Black folks, and then they passed laws that allowed them to use discretion to disenfranchise Black folks convicted of these crimes that they'd made up. That's where these laws came from. That's why there's so many and so strict in the South, and that's how these laws continue to operate today. So I think it's always important to keep that context in mind. And Florida is no exception to that. For a long time, everyone convicted of a felony in Florida lost the right to vote. The only way to get your voting rights restored in Florida was to go before this sort of archaic tribunal and plead your case for rights restoration. That all changed a few years back when the citizens of Florida overwhelmingly passed Amendment 4, which created automatic restoration of voting rights once somebody finishes probation or parole. But like you said, the legislature did not like that new rule. And so they passed a law that redefined sentence completion under Amendment 4 as including payment of fines, fees, and restitution. So the original Amendment 4 would have restored voting rights to 1.2 million people. That would have been the largest expansion of the franchise since women were given the right to vote. And then adding in the requirement that people pay off fines, fees, and restitutions significantly limited that. And what we've seen is only a few hundred thousand people have been able to get registered to vote, if even that, since the passage of that additional law that sort of redefined what sentence completion meant. Now, there were a number of lawsuits after that really complicated things. You know, there was a lot of mixed information the lower courts ruled that the law requiring payment of fines, fees, and restitution, you know, was unconstitutional. And then that was overturned by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. So there was a lot of mixed messages. Things were really confusing. What happened is that a lot of people ended up getting registered to vote who were not actually eligible under those fluctuating criteria. And now what we're seeing is Governor DeSantis going after those folks and prosecuting them for voting when ineligible, when all the evidence suggests that they had no idea that they couldn't cast a ballot.
Governor DeSantis made a very big show. He's the governor of stunts and drama, isn't he? But he said he was going to announce the arrests of people who committed voting fraud. He had proof of voter fraud. And it turned out to be a handful of people with past convictions who were able to vote and voted. And as you said, they all said they thought they had this right. And there's such confusion that they were allowed to register, even though apparently they should not have been. What's the status of prosecutions, if any, of these people that the governor has singled out?
So that's right. The governor made a big to-do saying that his new elections law enforcement task force had found all of these violations of election law. But what he left out and doesn't seem to understand is that violations of election law require that the individual knew that they were ineligible. So it's an element of the crimes of illegal registration that you know that you're not eligible to register. It's also an element of the crime of illegal voting that you know that you are not eligible to vote. Probable cause affidavits in these cases have no evidence that these people thought that they were ineligible. In fact, many of them did state that they believed that they were eligible. Some of them even asked officers of the state and counties if they could vote and were told yes. Universally, they all registered to vote, and those registrations were signed off on by the state. So they received something in the mail saying, yep, you're registered, here's how you vote. So they were all told that they could vote by some authority. And there's no, you know, in the vast majority of these cases, there's really nothing in the record that shows that they would have any reason to believe otherwise. So it's going to be really difficult for the prosecutors to prove that any of these people knew that they were ineligible. But unfortunately, of course, there's many costs to prosecutions, right? Being arrested. There's a video of one of these individuals being arrested in the early morning in his underwear. The cost of that, the cost of having to find a lawyer, you know, those are financial costs. Those are weights on your family. Those can jeopardize your employment. So there's a lot that's already happened to these people, despite the lack of probable cause around them knowing that they're ineligible. You know, the status of these right now is that none of them have gone to trial yet. But I think what DeSantis is hoping is that these people will plead out so that they'll have convictions on their records, even though it's going to be really difficult to actually prove that any of them committed a crime.
And it was such a small number of people. That's the other thing that's interesting to me. It was such a small number of people. So clearly those people in Florida who are impacted by these laws are trying to follow it. And yet we see these instances of a great deal of publicity over a handful of cases.
That's right. And I think that this is just the latest front in an over, you know, in a decades long project to build up the myth of voter fraud as a pretext for passing laws that make it harder for people to vote. This has been going on for a long time. And I think that the publicity around this effort serves that purpose to say, you know, there's widespread voter fraud and we need to pass laws that make it, that will eradicate that. But what those laws are really intended to do is just make it more difficult for people to vote And often they're particularly targeting communities of color and poor communities to impose barriers that will disproportionately impact them. Moreover, this, you know, this serves another purpose in the effort to keep people who were re-enfranchised by Amendment 4 from voting, because it's really going to scare people. This is a scare tactic. It's an intimidation tactic. It's meant to tell people, you know, even if you think you got your voting rights back in Florida, it's not worth it. Don't even try it. And, you know, I'll say on that, of course, there's lots of resources out there to help people find out if they're eligible and to go through that with them. And then I think that the third purpose this really serves is pushing this false and really destructive narrative that the election in 2020 had widespread fraud and was, you know, that the results were invalid. So pushing this myth that Trump won the election and that there was widespread fraud is also a big part of this strategy to just undermine faith in our democracy. So you can see why this move is attractive on many fronts to someone like Ron DeSantis.
And you mentioned the impact on communities of color. As we know, Black people are disproportionately impacted by the criminal justice system with, I believe it's half of those incarcerated are Black people, which of course means that the issue of disenfranchisement impacts Black people more. And it's a way for people like the governor of Florida and others to keep a segment of the population from voting who generally vote for one party, who are almost all Democratic Party voters. So this is an unfortunately successful tactic to determine election outcomes.
You know, the criminal legal system disproportionately targets Black communities as well as other communities of color. Black folks are more likely to be convicted under the system. They are more likely to see the imposition of high fines, fees, and restitution, and generally have less access to legal resources that might help fight convictions. And then on the other side, might help folks understand what the collateral consequences of a conviction are, like loss or restoration of voting rights. And Florida is certainly no exception to that. Over 15% of the Black voting age population in Florida is disenfranchised even after Amendment 4. And that's compared with around 7.5% of the total voting age population in Florida. So a huge disproportionate impact. And again, that's what these laws were designed for. These laws were originally designed to disenfranchise Black people specifically, and they do still serve that purpose today.
Tell us about restoreyourvote.org. How do you assist people who are impacted by these laws?
Yeah, so restoreyourvote.org is a free and confidential online tool that lets folks with past convictions determine if they're eligible to vote in their state. And if they're not, gives you step-by-step instructions for how you can restore your voting rights or what criteria you'll need to meet to restore your voting rights. So again, the vast majority of people with past felony convictions do have the right to vote already. So this tool is just really helpful for letting folks know that and getting that assurance. We also run a hotline behind it, and people can call us or they can email us. And we'll look more closely at their individual cases to really help them, again, sort of have that confidence to get registered if they're eligible, or to help them get the resources and materials that they need to restore their voting rights in their state.
That was Blair Bowie discussing voting rights for those with felony convictions.
Thank you for joining this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue every Wednesday.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Greetings. I'm Francesca D'Alessio with the WBAI Community Bulletin Board. We begin with the devastation in Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic from Hurricane Fiona. Project Hope has emergency response personnel in both Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic. It is mobilizing additional staff and volunteers for deployment. You can help them in their efforts by going to projecthope.org. That's projecthope.org. The Hispanic Federation is also on the ground with emergency relief services and essential supplies. The group is accepting donations on their website, HispanicFederation.org. That's HispanicFederation.org. And they are asking for checks payable to Hispanic Federation, Hurricane Relief Fund, and mailed to Puerto Rico Disaster Relief Fund, care of Hispanic Federation, 55 Exchange Place, New York, New York, 10005. Again, that's Puerto Rico Disaster Relief Fund, care of Hispanic Federation, 55 Exchange Place, New York, New York, 10005. The first feminist organization focused on women's health in Puerto Rico, Taller Salud, is also taking cash donations to help people in trouble because of the hurricane. They are also asking for non-perishable food items, toiletries, water, water filters, and solar lanterns. You can donate at tallersalud.com. Again, that is TallerSalud. .com. On Friday, September 23rd at 6:30 p.m., there's a rally concert for Puerto Rico at Hostess Community College in the Bronx on Grand Concourse. That's East 144th Street. For more information, go to hostos.cuny.edu/cultural arts. Again, that's hostos.cuny.edu/cultural arts, or call the Hostos box office at 718-518-4455. Again, that's 718-518-4455. Also in the Bronx, through September 25th, you can visit the Bronx Art Festival. It's the 8th annual art festival with the goal of cleaning up the Bronx one neighborhood at a time. This is at Boone Avenue in South Bronx. For more information, please contact Luis Arroyo, 718-925-1535. Again, that's 718-925-1535. And the Bronx Night Market returns on Saturday, September 24th from 1 to 7 p.m., celebrating cuisine, community, and culture in Uptown and the Bronx. That's at Fordham Plaza, rain or shine. For more information, check out the website, thebronxnightmarket.com. Again, that's thebronxnightmarket.com. Starting Thursday, September 22nd through Sunday, September 25th, from 9 a.m. till 2 p.m. in Manhattan, the Affordable Art Fair New York City returns to the Metropolitan Pavilion in Chelsea. That's at 125 West 18th Street. It's a showcase of contemporary artwork with local, national, and international artists. For more information, go to their website, affordableartfair.com. If you have an event you'd like to share with us, please email cbb@wbai.org. For the WBAI Community Bulletin Board, I'm Francesca D'Alessio.
Marcia Pendleton, producer and host of Backstage Stories on WBAI New York. We are thrilled to welcome Harriet D. Foy from the hit star show P-Valley and award-winning artist Germano Toussaint to the program. We'll talk about their careers and their musical collaboration and its first single, La-Di-Da. Don't miss this conversation with these multi-hyphenate powerhouses on Thursday, September 22nd at 9 p.m. on the next Backstage Story.